From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Jared Nolan.
And I'm Natalia Choi.
This week on War News Radio, Standing Together, we speak to an openly gay active duty service member about the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Finally, we speak to several experts about unrest in Cyprus.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Numerous sources confirm reports from Libyan rebels that Colonel Muammar Gaddafi is dead. War News Radio examines the reactions of the media and the international community to Gaddafi's death.
Uncertain and sometimes conflicting media coverage is surrounding the death of former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. The Associated Press reported that a NATO airstrike hit a convoy in which Gaddafi was attempting to escape. The BBC quoted a Libyan fighter who said he found Gaddafi in a sewer in Sirte. The New York Times reported he was captured alive, but died from injuries sustained to his head and legs. CBS cited an account saying Gaddafi was beaten and then shot with a 9mm pistol in a residential area of Sirte. The only constant, beyond Gaddafi's death itself, was contradiction. As coverage broke, graphic cell phone footage and images emerged, appearing to show Gaddafi's body. The scene is chaotic and the video dizzyingly shaky. Numerous armed men drag a man resembling Gaddafi outside. The man is covered in blood and unresponsive. But what's the impetus behind the media's speedy publication of this graphic content? Frederick Wary of the RAND Corporation, a military policy think tank, said the ubiquitous images were the byproduct of Libya's need for closure and newly independent press.
You do have to recall that Libya was a closed society for so long. There was rumor, there were lies. You know, his own media fed lies to the people all the time. And so for them to announce that Gaddafi was dead, you know, I think as part of the proof and to move the country forward and part of the catharsis, they needed to see the image of his body.
International leaders varied in response to Gaddafi's death, but were optimistic about the future of Libya.
People in Libya today have an even greater chance after this news of building themselves a strong and democratic future.
That was Prime Minister David Cameron of the United Kingdom.
This marks the end of a long and painful chapter for the people of Libya, who now have the opportunity to determine their own destiny in a new and democratic Libya.
That was United States President Barack Obama. On the ground, rebel Libyan forces were universally ecstatic and optimistic. NPR's Grant Clark reports on the scene in the capital city of Tripoli.
We have scenes of wild celebration across Tripoli, throngs of people out in the streets, many fighters firing their weapons in celebration, people chanting and singing.
Gaddafi's death comes with the fall of his final stronghold in Sirte. But where do these events leave Libya as a whole? Here's Wary.
Well, the next goal is the enormous task of rebuilding the country, and you have to remember, in many respects, they're starting from scratch. I mean, Gaddafi didn't allow any political organizations. People didn't know how to organize themselves politically.
Wary says Libya will have to work on several fronts in order to ensure political and economic stability. It will have to control arms and integrate rebel militias into a police force, while drafting a parliamentary system and managing oil resources. Wary also spoke of the need to balance justice for war criminals while integrating factions once loyal to Gaddafi.
I think it's obviously a euphoric moment, but I think the real hard work is just beginning.
For now, as Libyans begin to reconstruct their nation, the causes and consequences of Gaddafi's death are yet to be fully realized. For War News Radio, with Max Nestrak and Alan Zhao, I'm Amy DePiro.
The Separatist Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK, killed at least 24 Turkish soldiers during attacks against military outposts in Hakkari province in southeast Turkey. Within hours, Turkey launched a counteroffensive, pushing almost 3 miles into northern Iraq. Turkey's President Abdullah Gül promised revenge against the PKK, saying they will endure far greater pain. The attacks are the deadliest Turkey has seen since 1993. The PKK is labeled a terrorist organization by Turkey, President Barack Obama, and much of the international community.
The Associated Press reported this week that the United States has decided against keeping troops in Iraq past the planned December 31, 2011 withdrawal deadline, which was set in 2008. According to the AP, a senior Obama administration official said that only 160 American troops attached to the U.S. embassy in Baghdad would stay in Iraq past the deadline. However, the Obama administration later announced that the news report is false and that they have, in fact, made no final decisions. The U.S. and Iraq have been deep in discussion over keeping a small training force of U.S. troops past December, but have disagreed over legal issues. Iraq maintains that it will not grant U.S. troops immunity from criminal prosecution, instead insisting on holding soldiers subject to Iraqi law. These demands come after Iraqi outrage over abuses such as the Abu Ghraib prison scandal.
A prisoner swap between Israel and Palestine has led to the release of Israeli Sergeant Gilad Shalit in exchange for 1,027 Palestinians. The militant faction Hamas captured Shalit, then 19 years old, in 2006 during a cross-border raid. The deal has produced a range of reactions. Some view it as a positive sign for peacemaking and a step towards easing the Israeli blockade of the Gaza Strip. But militants in Palestine have said they must now abduct more Israeli soldiers to free around 5,000 Palestinian prisoners still held in Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned that any released prisoner who returns to violence will be subject to Israeli retaliation. Israelis were also upset over Shalit's health, describing him as frail and malnourished. Egypt brokered the negotiations.
At least 32 people were killed in Syria this week as confrontations between protesters and security forces continue. While reports of protests have come from around the country, they have been concentrated in the western city of Homs. There, activists have reported a heavy military presence and regular gunfire throughout the city. However, Syria's restriction on international journalists' travel within the country has prevented independent confirmation of the events. The United Nations estimates that at least 3,000 people have been killed since the protests began 7 months ago. The Syrian government says over 1,100 security officers have lost their lives.
Yemeni activist Tawakkul Karman traveled to New York, leading demonstrations against a UN Security Council draft resolution that would give Yemen's president Ali Abdullah Saleh immunity should he forfeit power. Karman, a recent Nobel Peace Prize winner, says she will not leave the city until the Security Council agrees to put Saleh on trial for the killing of Yemeni citizens. In Yemen, loyalists continue to open fire on protesters in Sana'a, the capital city, killing at least 35. Protesters have called for the resignation of President Saleh for the past 9 months.
President Obama has announced the deployment of around 100 military advisors to Central Africa. The combat-equipped troops will provide intelligence and support to forces fighting the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Central African Republic. The Lord's Resistance Army, led by Joseph Kony, has killed, raped, and kidnapped tens of thousands since it was formed over 20 years ago. The guerrilla force, thought to be only a few hundred fighters strong, has conducted roughly 250 attacks in 2011 alone and abducts children to use as soldiers in vicious massacres. Although the group does not pose a direct threat to the United States, it is a major source of instability in the region, and Kony is wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. There is no timetable for the deployment. In a letter to Congress, President Obama said U.S. forces will only fire in self-defense.
United States Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made a surprise visit to Tripoli, in the first U.S. cabinet-level official visit to Libya since rebels expelled Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Clinton arrived unannounced due to security concerns and held meetings with the National Transitional Council Chairman Mustafa Abdul Jalil, Prime Minister Mahmoud Jibril, and Finance Minister Ali Tarhouni. Clinton announced a new aid package of an additional $11 million for the country, bringing the U.S. contribution to Libya since the uprisings to roughly $135 million. Clinton is emphasizing that the U.S. will support democracy in Libya that respects the role of minorities, women, young people, and the independent press, and incorporates all factions in the future government. In a town hall meeting in Tripoli, she also stated that the U.S. would like Gaddafi to be captured or killed soon. Clinton's visit comes as intense conflict has increased in Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte, the the last remaining loyalist stronghold.
Clinton also made a surprise visit to Afghanistan, where she met with Afghan President Hamid Karzai and other officials in Kabul to urge them to lead and bolster Taliban reconciliation efforts. Clinton discussed a future strategic U.S.-Afghanistan partnership and the country's relationship with Pakistan as well.
This is War News Radio. In basic combat training, the United States Army teaches its soldiers to exemplify the military values of honor, integrity, and personal courage. Yet before September 20, 2011, many troops in the United States military were unable to fully embody these values under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the policy which prohibited them from serving openly as gays in the military. On the eve of the recent repeal, Yuan Xu spoke with a gay active duty member of the military and discussed the implications of a landmark new study about the policy.
When U.S. Air Force Captain Eddie Sweeney was first deployed in September of 2009, he was forced to hide an essential part of who he was, the fact that he was gay. Revealing this piece of information would threaten his position in the military and could result in an honorable discharge. Now, after 4 years of paranoia and caution, the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell marks the end of a daily struggle for the captain.
I couldn't tell people that I was with what was going on. And that's very difficult, especially when you're on a deployed environment and all you want to do is talk to somebody that, you know, that cares about you and loves you. And it can be hard. And it's very difficult to, in a way, lie to your colleagues who you trust and depend on every day about what you're doing when you don't feel like you're doing anything wrong.
Don't Ask, Don't Tell was enacted in late 1993 when it lifted a previous ban on gay service members in the military, allowing them to serve, but only if they did so without revealing their sexual orientation. Now, after years of political battles and more than 14,000 discharges under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the Pentagon officially repealed the 18-year-old policy on September 20, 2011. Enabling gays to serve openly and without reprisal in the military. The arduous process of the repeal has been a deeply personal one for Sweeney.
Last year, when we were waiting for the bill to be brought up in front of the Senate, you know, it came up, I think, three times total before it actually passed. And each time it was very emotional just to see, you know, the first few times it failed and finally the third time it passed. It's very moving.
There's evidence that Don't Ask, Don't Tell has an effect on the performance of gay servicemen, according to Benjamin Everly, a doctoral student at the UCLA School of Management, who recently concluded a study related to the policy.
There has been some previous research that shows that when individuals, whether they're gay or they're straight, are forced to conceal their sexual orientation, that they suffer cognitive depletion, and so they aren't able to perform as well.
The repeal of the policy signifies greater job security and the elimination of the fear of retribution that was instilled in many gay service members.
They don't have to worry about, A, lying to their colleagues that they respect, and B, if you're in a position of authority, if you have to make a really difficult decision, worrying about retribution in terms of somebody trying to retaliate against you because they think you're gay or you might be gay, and you've disciplined them in some way.
For those evaluating the implications of the repeal, the conservative nature of the military has been a cause of concern.
Very bound by tradition, and the fact that we're sort of moving past that and allowing, you know, male to male and female to female will be different for some people. That will change people's ideas and perspectives on what is, what was previously considered normal, if you will.
In a last-minute push to delay the repeal deadline, Congressman Representative Bud McKeon and Representative Joe Wilson argued that the policies and regulations necessary for the transition away from Don't Ask, Don't Tell were not yet finalized and that the military was not prepared for the repeal. Yet, despite the controversy it caused in Washington, Sweeney believes that the policy change will not be a cause of significant unrest in the military.
I think it will be a non-issue for the military. Most people that I've encountered, you know, they're professionals first and they'll do their job. But I think that people in the military are used to changes very abruptly. And I think that we're all professionals and we can handle it very well.
Sweeney does not believe that there will be a demonstrable increase in violence against gay service members after the repeal.
I think overall, speaking on a macro perspective, that the military overall is a very professional organization, and people who, you know, may not support it will keep their views to themselves and respect the decisions of our colleagues.
Sweeney's belief that the repeal will be a non-issue in the military was in fact first brought up in 1993 when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was first implemented. The National Defense Research Institute, which conducts research for a variety of defense agencies, concluded in a published study that if the policy were implemented with care, the ban on gays could be lifted with little or no adverse consequences for recruitment and retention. Now, the findings of a recent study by Everly suggest that the repeal may have positive implications for the military.
Well, the focus of the study was to see whether performance of teammates who worked with a gay colleague was affected by whether the gay colleague chose to disclose or conceal his sexual orientation. So what we found was that when the gay colleague chose to disclose his sexual orientation, his teammate actually performed better than when he concealed his sexual orientation.
Everly believes that the conclusions of the study are optimistic and bode well for those who are campaigning for the rights of gays in the Army. According to Sweeney, one issue that needs to be addressed is the lack of resources for LGBT, that is, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, service members.
One of the things that I personally found pretty shocking was even among the LGBT members in the military, they didn't know what was happening in Congress necessarily or what things affected them and what their rights were.
Along with being an Air Force captain, Sweeney also serves as the editor of OutServe magazine, an LGBT-oriented military magazine which is associated with OutServe, one of the largest resource groups for actively serving gay military members.
Our main goal and mission is to just be a source of information for LGBT troops and also for our straight counterparts in the military, just to demonstrate to them that we're no different than them.
OutServe is the first military magazine of its kind to be distributed not only online, but also at military bases. Sweeney hopes that the magazine will not only be a resource of information for LGBT service members, but that it will also help to lessen the divide between them and their straight colleagues.
There might be some things that make us separate from them, but together, collectively, we are still the United States military, and we'll fight for the freedoms that are important to us, and that's really our main goal.
Sweeney believes that though the fight to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell is over, there are many more battles to be fought before he is equal with his straight counterparts. Same-sex partners of gay service members are still unable to receive most of the extensive benefits that are provided to straight service members and their families.
We stand on the shoulders of giants. The people that have come before us and who have served and have gotten kicked out of the military and had no recognition whatsoever of their service because they were gay. And this is not something that is over by any means in terms of getting full equality or that, you know, was accomplished by myself or, you know, the people that OutServe alone. We have worked on what people before us have done. So we're very humbled by their efforts and we'll continue to push those efforts forward for equality.
According to David McKeon, the legal director for the nonprofit LGBT-oriented Service Members Legal Defense Network, obtaining key benefits such as healthcare coverage and housing allowances is the clear next step in the campaign for equal rights for gays in the military. For troops who are discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, re-enlisting in the military may prove difficult, as, according to Pentagon spokeswoman Aline Lanez, high retention rates, successful recruiting, and military force reductions have led to a decrease in the number of open positions for new and returning recruits. Even so, significant opposition to the repeal has dwindled, and the transition from Don't Ask, Don't Tell appears to be a quiet and peaceful affair, with no widely reported acts of unrest in the military thus far. For War News Radio, I'm Yuan Xu.
This is War News Radio. It's difficult to ignore ethnic division in a country that uses two national anthems. War News Radio's Sophia Athanasiadis spoke with a number of experts from Cyprus about the growing pressure to reach a peace agreement after nearly four decades of military occupation and numerous failed attempts for political reconciliation.
In October, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon will meet with leaders from both sides of the conflict in Cyprus with the hopes of fostering peace between the ethnically Turkish population in the north and ethnically Greek population in the south. Maria Hadjipavlou, a political science professor at the University of Cyprus, is less than optimistic for the reunification of the island, which has been divided along a United Nations-enforced buffer zone since 1974. Her skepticism is shared by many of the island's citizens.
The major issue with regard to the negotiations is that there is a lot of uncertainty. There are rumors that the UN really, they've had it with Cyprus. And we are fearful that there will be more deepening of this separation.
The conference comes at a time of particularly high tensions on the island, which stand to seriously jeopardize any chance the peace talks have of reaching a conclusive agreement. These negotiations, which began in 1968 under a UN mandate, have dragged on with little progress. Mrs. Hadjipavlou fears that without evidence of strong reconciliatory efforts from both communities, the UN may abandon the peace project altogether, as government forces in the Turkish capital of Ankara prep for military action.
Till now, I have not really seen trust as being one of the underlying foundations of these peace talks. I think they're not really peace talks. They're really bargaining. They're negotiations in the sense that each side sees what to get from the other. Instead of looking at the problem as a shared conflict, as a shared problem.
Hadjipavlou, who is also the founder of the Cyprus Peace Center and co-founder of the first independent non-governmental organization for women in Cyprus, cites division at the societal level as a major obstacle standing in the way of reunification, which she has, through her work with various organizations, experienced firsthand.
Because of my communal engagement, my peace work across the divide, I was very badly attacked by the right-wing press. So it was a time that it was very difficult for me. I was very badly misunderstood very often. Speaking about multiculturalism, they interpreted it that I was demeaning our Greekness.
For Hadjipavlou, agreements made by political forces will not necessarily alter societal relations between the two communities. Rather, she stresses the need to first develop a culture of coexistence.
I think what is really, really important is that the island has been divided the last 37 years. The two communities have really been leading their lives separately. It's not enough to say that we want a solution.
At this point, however, the prospect of reconciliation at the political level seems equally unlikely. The island's president, Dimitris Christofias, has confirmed that within a matter of weeks, Cyprus will begin exploratory oil drilling off of the southern coast, an operation being funded by the Texas-based corporation Noble Energy. This decision has prompted a number of military threats from Ankara, which maintains close ties to the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, a de facto state that unilaterally declared independence from the rest of the island in 1983. Andreas Theofanous, director of the Cyprus Center for European and International Affairs, a policy-oriented research institution, looks at what this means for international relations.
With developments in the Eastern Mediterranean recently, with the discovery of gas reserves in the economic zone of the Republic of Cyprus and Turkish assertiveness in relation to the issue, it attracted regional and international media.
According to the Ankara Anatolia News Agency, Turkish Minister for European Union Affairs Egemen Bagis has stated that if the pursuit of these gas reserves yields results, Ankara is prepared to respond with naval force in order to protect the economic interests of the island's northern Turkish population. From the Turkish point of view, This potentially lucrative drilling initiative would benefit only the southern, ethnically Greek citizens of the island, thus continuing the legacy of diminished rights and marginalization for the island's Turkish minority.
The Turkish Cypriot leadership, more often than not, is in line with Turkey, and there is a clear dependency.
Theofanos outlines the other side of the story, the Greek Cypriot sentiment surrounding the threats from Ankara.
The majority of Greek Cypriots feel that Turkey is an expansionist hegemonic power. It wants to dominate the area of the Eastern Mediterranean, and Turkey does not recognize the right of the Republic of Cyprus to exist.
Disagreement over oil reserves, however, is not the only thing standing in the way of a peaceful reunification. The independence of northern Cyprus is recognized only by Turkey, while the rest of the international community, including the United Nations, recognizes the legal authority of the Republic of Cyprus over the entire island.
Since 1974, Turkey occupies the northern part of Cyprus. It has here 40,000 troops. Turkey would like to see a resolution of the issue which would turn Cyprus into a protectorate.
Currently, Cyprus stands next in line to inherit the rotating presidency of the European Union in 2012. Former Turkish Minister of the Interior and current Deputy Prime Minister Bashir Atalay has warned that if Cyprus assumes the presidency, Ankara will freeze all relations with the European Union, which could ignite an international controversy.
Both the EU and the UN have invested a lot, hoping that there will be an end to this problem and we'll have a solution.
Turkey's reluctance to recognize the legitimacy of Cyprus, and therefore the European Union as a whole, may alter relations between Europe and the Muslim world, creating more space for future problems between these two global influences to emerge.
It's a very volatile situation now, so we don't know what will happen next year. We don't know what will happen by next week.
Whatever does happen in the coming weeks, however, will undoubtedly influence global politics, especially between Turkey, a European Union candidate, and the rest of the European powers.
Cyprus receives more attention than its size would suggest. At this stage, among other things, Cyprus is one of the chapters, one of the dimensions of Euro-Turkish relations.
As the UN conference grows closer, a progressive dialogue between the two sides seems improbable. A separate series of complications, including Turkey's rising influence in the Middle East, Greece's dire economic situation, and the historical legacy of violence and ethnic disagreement in the region, can only intensify escalating tensions.
Deep down, I know that things are very, very difficult because people define concepts and terms and so on very differently. They haven't found yet a shared language that is needed when you are willing to reach an agreement.
An end to UN peace efforts in Cyprus, which at present seems plausible, could spark a disastrous chain of events throughout both Europe and the Middle East. In the meantime, the world waits to see if Turkey will move forward with its threats and turn Cyprus once again into a violent conflict, only this time with much more of a global impact. For War News Radio, I'm Sophia Athanasiadis.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Eliana Biscard-Church, Amy DiPiero, Max Nesterak, Alan Zhao, Sam Hirschman, and Stuart Russell. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Jared Nolan.
And I'm Natalia Choi. Until next time, thanks for listening.